Oh yay, oh yay, oh yay. All listeners having business before the Capitol Press Room are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the Capitol Press Room's chief legal correspondent, Rob Rosbro, author of the New York Appeals blog and a litigation partner with Whiteman, Osterman, and Hanna, is now sitting. Welcome back to the show, Rob.
I feel just very distinguished to be here, David.
It is quite an honor. So back in November, the courts came out against restrictions imposed by Governor Cuomo regarding religious gatherings in areas which were targeted with pandemic restrictions. A federal judge has again weighed in on this issue. So what's the latest ruling and what does it mean for New York?
So like we talked about last November, the Supreme Court heard this case, the Catholic Diocese of Brooklyn case, and this in a companion case that was brought by a Jewish congregation. And now, after the Supreme Court held that it was very likely that the governor's executive orders were unconstitutional, a federal judge in the Eastern District of New York has entered a permanent injunction enjoining enforcement of the house of worship restrictions, which limited houses of worship to 25% occupancy or 10 people in red zones, or 33% occupancy or 25 people in orange zones. So the state, consented to a permanent injunction of that restriction, which means it can no longer be enforced, basically seeing the writing on the wall that this was going to get struck down if they didn't do that. Notably here, the state in the case told the federal judge that it's likely that this religious worship restriction is going to be revised and taken out of upcoming executive orders. So the order will only really have effect for the next couple of weeks, but it served its purpose. People who want to worship can now do so in New York.
Yeah, if the state does want to move forward with any sort of religious restrictions in the future, is there something about either this ruling or the preliminary injunction back in November that will shape how the state goes about drawing those restrictions? Is there something that they will have to follow, like, say, a certain test?
Yes, definitely. So they have to satisfy the strict scrutiny test, which means you need a very narrowly tailored restriction that does not impair constitutional rights. And here, for the religious exemption in particular, they need to be treating religious worship the same as they're treating essential businesses, because that was the distinction that really sunk these restrictions here. You could go, into a grocery store, or, notably mentioned, an acupuncturist had no capacity restrictions, but capacity restrictions were placed on religious worship. And the courts weren't going to tolerate that. So any, future religious worship restrictions will have to be mindful of that.
What about, say, restrictions posed on maybe like gun stores in the future? If we do have lockdowns on businesses, would there need to be special dispensations for, a person's ability to exercise their Second Amendment rights and purchase a gun? Or is that sort of a different test because the gun stores be looped in with retail stores more generally?
That's an interesting question. I think that's certainly a closer case, but the right to, bear arms is a constitutional right, just like the right to religious worship. And I would imagine that you'd want to see sort of a narrowly tailored interest, though I don't suspect that strict scrutiny actually would apply to that one.
So following up on another case that originated in 2020, which had to do with restrictions on the size of weddings, can you explain the latest developments there?
Sure. Just about a week ago, the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, which was reviewing the wedding case, issued an order dismissing the appeal as moot. So one of the, there were four plaintiffs in the case, two of which already got married, so they don't have any rights left to be adjudicated. And the two others told the court that they were not going to go forward with the wedding while the COVID restrictions were in place. So while the court had preliminarily enjoined enforcement of the 50-person wedding limitation for those particular weddings, that restriction is now back in place after the court's order, because the people who had brought the case no longer had any rights to adjudicate, and the courts are not going to give an advisory opinion. They actually need someone with an interest at stake to be able to say what everyone's rights are.
Well, starting this spring, the governor says the state will allow weddings of up to 150 people, depending on the capacity of the venue. Do the challenges to those previous restrictions of about 50 people offer any insight into how a court might rule if, you know, a couple does bring a legal challenge because, say, they want 151 guests at their nuptials and celebration?
It does. The court's adjudicating a new case, whether it's brought by the couple who changes its mind and wants to have a wedding during COVID, or any other couple who wants to get married relatively soon. The courts will look to these decisions as providing the review framework, and the restrictions that the governor draws will have to ensure that it's protecting the rights that that the court said it needed to be protected, which means you need to treat, you know, similarly situated individuals and venues the same.
Is there a religious argument to be made in this case as well? You know, if I have a wedding, say, in a church or a synagogue or a mosque, you know, could I be allowed to exceed that 150 person cap because of, say, my religious beliefs?
You know, in that kind of case, I would imagine that it would be bifurcated what the court looks at. So the court would look at the actual religious service as part of the, you know, right to worship. So if it's in a synagogue or if it's in a church, the capacity restrictions that, you know, the court has enjoined now won't apply. You can have probably as many people as the church is comfortable with at the actual wedding mass or a wedding service. But for the reception afterwards, it will be treated differently, much more like the wedding cases were here, where the courts were looking at, you know, are similarly situated people being treated the same? And, you know, does the state have a rational justification for, you know, limiting in-venue dining like a reception?
Did you have more or less than 150 people at your wedding?
I had more than 150 people at my wedding long time ago.
Was that overkill?
It was. Far too many people there.
People should take heed of that advice as they think about the restriction moving forward, I guess. So we're breaking down the legal news in New York, and our guest is Rob Rosbro, author of the New York Appeals Blog and a litigation partner with Whiteman, Osterman, and Hanna. So the top court in New York, the Court of Appeals, made news this week with a decision about the legality of the Manhattan DA's office prosecuting Paul Manafort for crimes he was recently pardoned for by Donald Trump at the federal level. What did the court decide, and what's the practical effect of that decision?
Back in October, the Appellate Division First Department held that the New York County District Attorney's attempt to prosecute Paul Manafort for the same crimes that he was prosecuted and convicted for on the federal level violated New York's double jeopardy ban. So New York doesn't, you know, allow for the same person to be prosecuted for two offenses on the same act or criminal transaction. And that's basically what Five Vance was trying to do here. The U.S. Constitution has a different double jeopardy restriction, but New York's is stronger here. It says, you know, no matter whether this was, as long as it's the same offense and the same crimes, and the same victims, you're going to run up against the double jeopardy bar. The Court of Appeals here in New York just last week denied the people's criminal leave application. So it declined to review the Appellate Division's order, leaving that order in place. You know, the court didn't actually take any substantive look at the case. It just decided not to hear it.
In the wake of the time period that these crimes were committed, New York State has changed its double jeopardy laws with the idea of going after people that Donald Trump might have pardoned while in office. If these crimes had been committed, say, after that law took effect, is it possible that Vance would have a clear lane for prosecuting Manafort now?
Yes, it would be much easier under the new law now, and that's exactly what the intention of the new law was to allow for the criminal prosecution in New York of crimes that would have otherwise been pardoned on the federal level. But Manafort's case fell before the effective date of the new double jeopardy law in New York, so he was still governed by the prior law, and there was no way around that for this prosecution.
And finally, we got a state lawsuit last week from the election technology company Smartmatic against Fox News, three of its star anchors, and Trump defenders Rudy Giuliani and Sidney Powell. What's the story behind their $2.7 million defamation case?
Smartmatic is, like you said, an election technology company that provided its software only in Los Angeles County for the 2000 election. But Fox created a story, according to the allegations of the complaint, where Smartmatic was the villain that, caused the rigging of the election for Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. And the complaint is a masterful class in writing. I mean, just this is what the first paragraph says. The earth is round. 2 + 2 = 4. Joe Biden and Kamala Harris won the 2020 election for president and vice president of the United States. The election was not stolen, rigged, or fixed. These are facts. They are demonstrable and irrefutable. And what the allegations are is that Fox created this story. Its anchors propounded this story so that they could make money off of destroying Smartmatic's reputation. And so the complaint alleges that Smartmatic has lost or will lose $2.7 billion. It will be really interesting to see how this one proceeds in the New York courts.
So what is the threshold for proving Smartmatic's business is actually taking a hit because of comments from Sidney Powell and Rudy Giuliani and anchors on Fox News? Because the election officials I hear from have really no doubt about the legitimacy of the 2020 election administration and likely wouldn't be deterred from doing business with a company that might have been besmirched by these non-credible sources.
What their allegations are is that the allegations against Smartmatic of election fraud in states that the Fox News and its anchors knew Smartmatic or did not participate in the election for, that's a provable falsity, according to the complaint, and that the damages would be based on damage to its reputation and business acumen, which, there are mere allegations now, and Smartmatic will have to prove what they lost and what they could lose in the future from either current clients or prospective clients who walked away from deals. And then if they can't end up proving it because election officials, keep retaining Smartmatic, or if they didn't lose any current business, then the complaint can actually fail for lack of damages. But right now, they've alleged that that's been enough to sustain or to move forward with a complaint.
Well, we've been speaking with the Capitol Press Room's legal correspondent, Rob Rosbrough, author of the New York Appeals blog and a litigation partner with Whiteman, Osterman, and Hanna. Rob, thanks so much for making the time.
Thanks again, David.
Support for the Capitol Press Room is provided by the New York State AFL-CIO, a federation of 3,000 unions fighting for working people by keeping New York State union strong. UnionStrongNY.com for more information.